Let me also say good morning. Welcome. We're glad you're here, especially if any are joining us that are new or only occasional. We're delighted God has led you to this place at this time. Easter is the highest point in the Christian calendar. It is the most light-filled, beautiful, glorious. It elicits worship that is glorious among us. And it was surely our experience in this church this year that Easter was a marvelous time of seeing the Lord risen indeed. And I want to thank all of the folks who made Holy Week a tremendous experience here. There's a lot of folks who served and led and thought about ways that could make our experience full, and I want to say a special word of thanks to them. But we have a curiosity that our calendars have arranged for us this year, something that's a little unusual. Easter is the high point of the Christian calendar, and in most cases in this church and other Christian bodies, there's some preparation that goes on ahead of time. The 6 weeks or so of Lent leading up to Good Friday and Easter are often a time to prepare ourselves for seeing and hearing and thinking through the events of Jesus' death and resurrection. But because we're studying the Gospel of John and are studying it through from beginning to end, and because we began in September, we are now in chapter 18 of John, which takes us back to the very night that Jesus was arrested and tried, to the beginning, as Scott said, of the awful darkness descending for him and for his followers. So we're going to do the mirror image, something like the mirror image of Lent, and take the 6 weeks or so following Easter and hear John tell us the story again. And there's some reason for this. This makes sense in one capacity, in that John's gospel almost certainly was written after the others were available to the early church. So we might say that because they knew the story, because they'd heard the earliest Christians had heard the story of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, had texts even by which they could read and think about Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, John wrote them to give another perspective, to go back over it, if you will. And so we're going to let John do that for us. And John's gospel is ideal for this, partly because he takes us places that the other writers don't. And the places tend to be the interior places. John speaks more about what Jesus was thinking as events unfolded. He takes us into conversations in some detail, illuminating what was going on more than others do in some cases. There are portraits painted by John of individuals that we are aware of other places but don't get to know quite so well. Pilate, Mary Magdalene, Thomas. These come alive in John's telling in ways that we would have missed out on if we only had the other gospel writers. So because John is, the book of John is, as some have named it, the intimate gospel, I think we'll find ourselves privileged to retell the stories that our church calendar has just led us through. We're going to retell them again and hopefully see them as John illuminates them for us. The book of John begins with the announcement, or with a challenge, if you will. If you go back to the first chapter, we read this. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The conflict is clear from the beginning. The light shines unwaveringly. And the darkness is determined to extinguish it. The challenge, the conflict is there from the beginning, the shining light, the role of the darkness to put out the light. And that theme can be followed throughout the gospel. It's one of the themes that we're aware of all the way along. We are now in chapter 18. I'll begin reading there in a moment. And this is perhaps the time when the darkness has had its way most thoroughly and seems most likely to prevail. The chapters from 13 through 18 of John cover one single period of darkness. There are six chapters that are devoted to the period from dinner to daybreak on one night, the night in which Jesus will begin to give himself to his enemies for our sake. And the dinner beginning to this night's events has a telling moment in it. As the disciples sit with Jesus on the Passover dinner, in which he is teaching them of his love for them and explaining his love for them, there's an awful moment that happens at the dinner party, verse 27 of chapter 13. Then after he, that is Judas, had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, "What you are going to do, do quickly." So after receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. John is not telling us about the nighttime because we didn't already know. He's telling us because the night is exerting pressure on all these events. Judas was gripped by the darkness of night and would never find himself free again. The night is beginning its drumbeat. The darkness has arrived, and the darkness fills everything we're going to see from here on out this morning in chapter 18. There's two sections in the text we're going to read, two stories, if you will. One takes place outdoors on the Mount of Olives in the region of Gethsemane, where there was a garden. And we'll see Jesus there arrested. And that's scene number one. And Peter plays the role of kind of a foil, if you will. His actions are not significant in any way to what's going to happen. He doesn't contribute anything to the unrolling of history, but he acts in a way that I think will help us enter the story. Peter serves to put us in the text. He acts in a foolish and ridiculous and humiliating way, and he does so for reasons that I think we can speculate about, and as we see what Jesus is doing, we can see Peter there, and we can say, boy, I get that. I understand. He's letting me be part of this story on some level. The second account takes place in the home of a man named Annas, one of the high priests of Israel during this time, and it is darkness. It is the darkness of decayed religion. It takes place inside, and certainly there was illumination in the room. But what is dark about the trial before Annas is the failure of law and order, godless priests, phony prosecution, warped justice. And here also we find Peter. Peter out in the courtyard denying the Lord and descending to the lowest point of his entire life. So in the first case, we have the darkness of the betrayer, soldiers and guards, torches and swords, marching at midnight to extinguish the light of the world. In the second place, we have the darkness of decayed religion and the false priesthood of Annas and all the phony justice of a kangaroo court. And Peter there in each case, letting us perhaps see ourselves in the story. So with that in mind, let me turn to chapter 18, verse 1 and begin reading. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who had betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Who do you seek?" They said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I lost not one." Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck back the high priest's servant's struck back the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" What surely strikes us first about this scene is the incongruity of Jesus' mastery of every element of this moment and the utter unlikelihood of him being so. He, with a handful of friends, unarmed, set upon by what John records as a cohort of Roman soldiers. And a cohort in the first century in kind of Roman military language was 600 soldiers. Now, I don't think all 600 were there. Some part of the cohort was there. But it was not insubstantial. These were serious, trained, violent Roman legionnaires. And along with them are the guards of the temple police. And these all are being led by the betrayer. And Jesus, it says, we read, went forth from the garden. He wasn't cowering, waiting to be discovered. As soon as this large body of those come to arrest him were in sight, he steps out. And his master events. He takes over the interview. He determines what's going to happen, under what circumstances it's going to happen, and when. The verb to come forth, it says he came forth or walked out of the garden, is used in chapter 13 of John when we read in verse 3, he came forth from God. It's a very strong term. It describes the incarnation, if you will. It's reasonable to speak of something so dramatic as that. And here it says he came forth solemnly with full authority and begins to run the show. And the first thing he asks is, who are you looking for? It's a big crowd. What are you all doing here? And they said, we're seeking, asked whom they're seeking. They say, Jesus of Nazareth, which is the smallest term they could have used for him. They aren't saying, well, we're seeking Jesus the miracle worker, or we're seeking Jesus the teacher, or we're seeking Jesus something else. They try to say, we're looking for the bumpkin from Galilee, the Nazarene, and so on. We're looking for that guy. And his answer is, I wish we could see a video of this event and hear his voice and see his face. He says simply, "Ego, a me." Now, he is answering their question. That sentence can be translated, "I am he." That's what it means. That's one of the things it means. And depending on how he said it, maybe he just is answering their questions. But they didn't fall down, because he was simply answering their question in that sense. The phrase ego eimi is also Greek for the term used in the burning bush when Moses spoke to God and asked what God's name is, and the answer from the bush was, "I am who I am." The ego eimi, there is no predicate here, it just means I am. And Jesus is using the name of God. And he's doing it in a way that is utterly compelling to Romans and Jews alike, and people fall down hearing him say, "I am essentially who I am." There are times in John when he will say, "I am something. I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am something." But there are other times in John where he just says, as he does here, "I am." And his enemies, their knees involuntarily buckle and they fall to the ground. He issues orders to protect his disciples. He basically says this, "Here's how it's going to work, guys. I'm going to go with you. I need to be arrested. I agree to be arrested. You're going to leave them alone, and that's how it's going to turn out." He is a master of these events. He said in chapter 10, verse 18 of John, "No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord." He was not taken against his will. He was not taken for the purposes that his arresters intended. And when Peter acts out, as we'll see him do in a minute, or talk about in a minute, in his foolishness. Jesus finally turns to him and said, what are you doing? Why are you trying to stop something that must happen? I'm going to drink the cup my Father has given me. I've already agreed to give up my life. I've already agreed on my terms that I'll go to the cross. He is beginning to end the master of this scene. One thing we can say, I think, might well observe, is that some of what happens here is a pattern for discipleship that we could see in our own experience. And it goes something like this. Jesus, it says in verse 4, knew ahead of time everything that was going to happen. He already knows what's going to happen. These events are known to him. It says he went forth. His disciples go with him. They are put in danger by what he's doing and what he knows. He protects them, having put them in danger. And then he fulfills his mission, accomplishing everything he intends. A lot of times our lives are like that, aren't they? Following Jesus gets us in danger. He goes somewhere, we've got to go with him, and all of a sudden the world looks awfully dark and dangerous, and who knows what the heck's going to happen, and I would never have gotten myself into this mess if it was up to me. But I'm here with him. And in the long run, being here with him means he's going to protect us in the place where he's taken us, and then finally he's going to end the circumstance on his own terms. There's something of a pattern of what it means to be a disciple, I think, in these verses. But I think we also might do well to look more directly at Peter. What is going on with Peter? This whole crowd of soldiers, handful of disciples, Jesus standing as master of the scene, and Peter says, I know it's a good idea. I'll pull out my sword and hack a guy's ear off. This is a great idea. This is just the time for me to do something stupid. Now, why would he do it? What would compel him to? Why was this? Would this seem like a good idea on any level? Well, there's two possibilities that strike me. What could have been motivating Peter? I think two things, and maybe they can be held together. They don't exclude one another. The first is he thinks Jesus has lost his marbles. Maybe we can imagine him saying, "If I create a diversion over here with a sword and an ear and a little bit of blood, maybe Jesus can run for it and sneak out the back of the garden and get away. Maybe I can do something that will save him, because clearly him dying is the worst possible thing, and he doesn't know that. He hasn't figured it out. He's lost track of the dangerous world we're in, and it's about time somebody did something for him." And I think many of us in this room and churches throughout history and Christian organizations all over the place think that way without admitting it or realizing it often. The Lord has lost track of the deal. It's about time some of us did something. This whole strategy of sacrificial love takes too long. It's behind the times. The gospel needs a rewrite. Kind of the compelling old truth isn't working anymore. It's time for us to hire some celebrity spokespeople and raise some more money and get a database and, you know, make this thing happen. He doesn't know what he's doing anymore. And on some level, Peter's doing that. But what happens when you cut off ears? And I think the Christian church, maybe us as individuals, we do it over and over again. All you do is irritate everybody. You leave scars. You suggest retaliation. Well, if you're going to cut off our ears, you know, here it comes. You make a mess of things. It doesn't accomplish anything, and it in fact invites antagonism and brings about retaliation. Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, he says a very important thing about weaponry, I think, that's worth hearing. The weapons, he says, of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. The weapons which make a difference are divine, have God's power in them, and they tear down strongholds. And where do strongholds exist? They exist in our heart. Lopping off someone's ear does nothing. How will we, for Jesus' sake, participate in the tearing down of the strongholds of darkness and guilt and fear and anger and arrogance and pride. What tears down those strongholds? It is sacrificial love. It is dependence on the Spirit of God. It is speaking the truth and being willing for it to do its work, and so on and so on and so on. Chopping off ears is a great foolishness. And Peter did it on the one hand because he thought, perhaps, we're speculating, that Jesus didn't know what he was up to. I think there might even, and more likely, is a personal piece to this too. Peter bragged with some clarity about how courageous he was. Peter had frequently jumped in front of the Lord to stop him from doing what he was about to do. Oh no, you can't go to Jerusalem. I'm not going to permit it. Get behind me, Satan. You washing feet? Okay, you're going to wash everybody. Not my feet. Boy, I'll tell you what, not my feet. We're all going to get scattered. No, I'm not going to get scattered. I'm going to die with you. I'm the one. Always the losers everywhere in this room, but not me. And he had by this time painted himself into a situation where if he didn't do something, he couldn't contain himself. And so in order, as a kind of grandiose gesture to cover his inadequacy and the foolish self-portrait he'd painted as if Jesus didn't know, you know, strikes out with the sword and if the Lord hadn't intervened, would have created another mess and done him no good. Done neither Peter nor Jesus any good. I think Peter's claims of competency, he's trying to defend them now, and all he does is humiliate himself in the process. Well, the second scene, the second darkness scene, takes place, as I said, indoors in the house of Annas. So we'll turn to verse 12 and begin reading. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I'm dropping down. By the way, I dropped from 15 to 19. Jesus answered him, "I've spoken openly to the world. I've always done in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews, I have always done so in the synagogue and temples where the Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard what I've said. They know what I have said." When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If what I have said is wrong, bear witness to the wrong. But if what I have said is right, why do you strike me?" Annas then sent him, bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. The darkness here is of priests who are not priests at all. It's a darkness of corruption. It's the darkness of spiritual decay. Jesus is the light of the world. The darkness will not extinguish him. But Jesus is also the true high priest for everyone whom God will call. He is the one who will stand for us and draw us to the presence of God. And these men have given up every right to speak in those terms. There's a terrible line in here that's easy to pass over. It said that Caiaphas was high priest that year. Now, the high priesthood was a lifetime appointment. It was not something that got traded in every year. And what we know from the history of the time is that Annas was kind of the old spider in the web. And he had managed over time to cut deals with Rome so that at times he was the high priest, sometimes one or more of his sons was, and this year Caiaphas, his son-in-law, was the high priest. And all of it was as if God can be represented by people who will sell out to Rome, let Rome put in place whomever they want, do the bidding of this occupying power, as if Rome was master, not God, and they got paid off to do it. The family of Annas was one of the wealthiest anywhere because they'd given up the right to their heritage, to be who they had been called to be in order to get along with Rome and in order to get paid off to do it. And at one level, if you go, remember you go back in chapter 11 when Caiaphas was in a council and he said, it's expedient that one man should die for the people. It's quoted again here. You can see what their thought process is. We've got this whole religious enterprise. We've got this temple. It took us a horrible heck of a long time to rebuild it again. We've got all this stuff. We're an occupied people. We're hanging on by our fingernails. The last thing in the world we can do is afford to hassle Rome. And so let's compromise. Let's do what they want. And let's lie if we have to. And let's be hypocrites to the nth degree. But we got to keep the thing going. What will happen if we don't genuflect when the Romans say to do so? Paul, in another place, says that they had become like those who had the form of godliness but denied its power. There was nothing of God about them. And so Jesus is in this setting, in that dark place with that kind of darkness. And a number of folks have written about the failures of the trial. It was, for instance, it was illegal, specifically illegal for Jewish courts to have a trial at night. Forbidden. They were required in serious matters to have a trial that lasted over two consecutive days, so there's no rush to judgment. It has to take at least 2 days. This trial took place at night in a couple of hours. They're required to have evidence. They're required to have witnesses. There's all manner of requirements for a trial to have any standing at all, and they break all of them. They had determined ahead of time the decision they wanted. They're going to find him guilty. This is a sham. They're going through the motions. And a last observation to make just of this scene is what seems to be an underlying assumption of cunning. Because they were devious and liars and made backroom arrangements and under-the-table payoffs, they cannot, it appears, seem to imagine that Jesus isn't doing the same thing. So they say, okay, now tell us the truth. What have you got going on? What's the network? Where do you? How do you assume that you're going to get anywhere with this kind of religious game you're playing? And the Lord keeps answering them, I already said. Whatever I said in public. Ask the people who have heard it. There is no other part to this. There is no under-the-table payoff. There is no cunning dark place that I'm part of. I am in public who I am. What I've said, I've said. I'm not like that. And it seems, you know, again, not to make too much of it, but it seems like they can't imagine a world in which somebody just is who he says he is and tells the truth and doesn't sort of have a dark side to him that can be exploited. They're looking to exploit his hypocrisy, and they can't find any. Ask the people who heard me. That's what I've said. There is no more. Well, Jesus, even though he's struck on the face, turning his other cheek, he remains master of this scene as much as he did the other. Tell me what I've said this wrong. Give evidence if you can. And Annas has to get rid of him and sends him off for more nighttime trials, more nighttime interrogations to take place. So what about Peter in the courtyard of the house of Annas? This is our last reading for now. Verse 15, Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest, but Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I'm not." By the way, that is the direct negation of Jesus' statement before the soldiers. "We're looking for Jesus of Nazareth." "I am," said the Lord. It's the same verb, the same Greek verb with a negation in front of it. "I am not," said Peter. And you can see John's genius in kind of writing the dialogue. I am nothing like him. I am not. Verse 18, now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Dropping down to 25. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, You are not one of his disciples, are you? He denied it, I am not. One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter again denied it, and at once a rooster crowed. Peter's story has no bearing whatsoever on what will happen. In the same way, his ear cutting off thing had nothing to do with how the story would turn out. His denial or lack thereof, whatever he says or does in this setting, is completely to the side. Jesus is going to die on schedule without any contribution from Peter. But it's heartbreaking to see the trial in the courtyard going on at the same time as the trial in the house, isn't it? There Annas is questioning Jesus, and Jesus is answering forthrightly. In the courtyard, some onlookers are questioning Peter, and he's lying, denying, bearing false testimony. It says that he can't get warm. Do you notice that? Twice, standing, warming himself by a charcoal fire. It's as if there's something, it's dark, it's nighttime, it's getting colder and colder, but the coldness in Peter's life is starting to proceed from the inside. Everything is about to go as wrong as it possibly can. And we find him before this charcoal fire. And finally, he descends to the deepest place. And as Jesus is being sent on, further on, to his own execution, Peter runs away. And we're told in the other Gospels that he wept bitterly, as lost as a man can be. As dark as a man can be, as cold as a man can be. No charcoal fire can warm him. But we also know this about Peter, that his actions didn't surprise the Lord. Jesus knew what Peter would do. He told him ahead of time, this is what you're going to do. He told him ahead of time, that's not the end of your story. Jesus was not surprised. His own death didn't surprise him. Peter's failure didn't surprise him. There was none of this came as a shock, and it is also, I think we can say confidently, it was also necessary for Peter to fail. If he had not discovered the depths of his own lies to himself, his own inability, if he had continued to imagine himself heroic when he was not, he would never have been any good to God or anyone else. It was his discovery of the cold and the dark and the lies and the pretense that made him available to become the great apostle to the Jews, the great preacher on Pentecost, and so on. Lastly, I want to say is that as dark as this event, we're leaving at the moment of maximum nighttime. There is nothing good in sight, and everything bad that has happened. The events are turning as wrong as they could, although Jesus seems completely master of them in any case. But if you just look at what's happening, it's horrific and leading to more. I want to just look at John's foreshadowing with his use of a charcoal fire, just as a last observation. It says that Peter, still in denial and denying the Lord, kept trying to warm himself, but he couldn't. Then John has a story yet to come of another charcoal fire on a beach in Galilee when Peter's there and Jesus is there as well. And Peter loses everything at this event, and it's restored to him again at another event of the same sort, a place where it is warm finally, warm enough for to be given back his identity, to be forgiven, to be able to claim his faith and have Jesus acknowledge it. And as dark as this moment is, it's not the end. And of course, we know that. But we can look forward to how the people living through this sought resolution and found faith. Let's pray. Lord, we're going back over territory that's just, we culminated last week. We sang of the resurrection. Now we're going back to the trial and to the tears and to the lies and to the blood and all of that. Illuminate it for us, Lord. Help us, because we have such hope of the resurrection, give us insight into why we need your death and your life. In Jesus' name, amen.